Thanks, everyone. So I think it's probably time to start this session. So the title for this session is The Non-Challenges of an Aging Population. And Frank Ash will be presenting this topic. So just a bit of a bio on Frank. So he's a doctor. Dr. Frank Ash has a consulting practice specializing in risk management and investments. Risk management covers the gamut from culture and behavioral psychology to technical matters and derivative risk to strategy to asset liability management to comparative corporate governance. He's an honorary fellow at the Macquarie University of Applied Finance Center. He regularly travels through Southeast Asia and East Asia, consulting and giving seminars, in-house training programs, and master's levels university courses. Dr. Ash is a member of the Australian Institute of Company Directors. So I'll now pass on to Ash to start his presentation. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, I think this is a reasonable way of bookending the conference. Not that I'm the last speaker, but I'm the last concurrent speaker. The first session was the problems of an aging population, and I'm talking about the non-problems of an aging population. Because I don't think that there is a problem. And the real problem is that people are using the fact that we have an aging population to push an ideological construct. And so I've essentially got a heretical perspective on the aging population. Okay, what is perceived to be the problem? Well, who's funding things? And this comes from the intergenerational report, and for those people who went to the concurrent session yesterday that said the 2015 intergenerational report was rubbish, you'll be pleased to know that I'm using the intergenerational report from 2010, which wasn't rubbish. Okay, what did they say? Unless action is taken to increase the growth potential of the economy and ensure spending is sustainable, spending will exceed revenue and result in a fiscal gap of 2.75% of GDP by 2049-50. If steps were not taken to close the fiscal gap over time, it is projected that net debt will emerge in the 2040s and grow to around 20% of GDP by 2049-50. Acting now to address fiscal pressures posed by ageing will minimise the fiscal adjustments required in the future. That sounds frightening. That sounds like we really have to get onto things. A fiscal gap of 2.75% of GDP by 2049, that's actually not very large. A projected net debt emerging in the 2040s and growing to around about 20% of GDP by 2049, that's not particularly large. If we look at what other economies are running worldwide, we find that those are actually very, very reasonable numbers to work with. But it's presented as a problem. We've got to do something about this. And we've got to do something now. This is from a colleague. You can actually see who, well down the page there in little writing, so I don't want to say that. But, you know, what is it? Population ageing is a multi-waved tsunami. You know, we've got negative net migration, we've got gender imbalance, increased longevity, lower fertility. Tsunami is a loaded word. We never talk about tsunami as something that's good. So we're talking about, you know, the ageing population in a negative context. Right. I'm not going to show any charts, no real numbers in this particular talk. I'm actually going to be talking about linguistic concepts and psychological concepts. So that might suit the late afternoon sessions, but it also might take many of you out of your comfort zone. There's no numbers here. This is linguistic and philosophical. Okay. The UN is onto it. Here's the old age support ratio for the world and development the world and development regions. 1950 to 2050, we're looking at the support ratio. Wow, all of these numbers show that we've got a smaller number of working age people who are supporting each person age 65 years and over. Terrible stuff. We must do something about that. Shock, we've got a negative demographic dividend. We all know that negative dividends are not good. Anything negative is not good. And dividend is another loaded word. We want dividends to be positive. So it doesn't matter how you interpret those. It is the words that are associated with this, right? We've got a negative demographic dividend, right? Some of those words... the values below zero indicate a negative dividend. That is a period during which demographic change is contributing to a reduction in economic growth, all things being equal. And we know economic growth is good. We've had that drummed into us for years and years and years. China. It's getting old before it gets rich. That sounds pretty terrible. We'd all like to get rich before we get old. If you're doing things back to front, then that's not good. You know. And what have we got? A comparison with America reveals a deep flaw in China's model of growth. You know, even The Economist, that reputable journal, is getting down there and saying negative things about the aging population in China. Health costs are rising. This is from a 2014 report from a very august institution, the Australian Institute of Actuaries. Now, what are they saying? Our population is predicted to live significantly longer, and forecasts indicate that spending on healthcare across all levels of government is expected to grow some 6.5% to 10.8% of GDP over the next 50 years. You can almost hear the shock and horror in that sentence. Some intergenerational cross-subsidy is an inevitable part of healthcare system, as it is with other services, but the cost on the working population through taxation needs to be addressed in order to protect the quality of Australia's healthcare services and system. Yeah, we've got to do something, and the sooner we do it, the better, because, hey, we're all getting older, and that's going to affect the quality of the healthcare system. Oh, okay. That ends the first part of the talk. Everybody's talking negatively about population ageing. You know, that was the first plenary session, the challenges, right? If things weren't negative, they wouldn't be challenges. You know, we'd be talking about, hey, look at the great opportunities we've got. Everybody's happy. Okay. Talking money is the problem. That is a major problem when we start talking about things in a macroeconomic, total society framework. Once we start talking about money, we are constraining the way that we think. Subconsciously, I'm not saying that anybody is automatically constraining the way that they think about these things, but it is subconscious. We've done plenty of psychological tests where we know that once we introduce money into any sort of discussion, people's mindset changes. They actually, from any moral sense, they actually become more negative in a moral sense. So talking about things in terms of money is not the right process. What would I suggest is the right process to talk about these things? The primary thing is actually talking about the non-monetary economy. Can we produce and distribute the goods and services to meet projected demand? Yes. We know that healthcare costs are going to rise to be 10.8% of GDP from 6.5% of GDP. Wrong way. Can we actually meet that? That's the question. Can we actually give, can the people who need that, those health costs, can they actually pay for it so that the, you know, we get that circular economy? And there we go. That's the secondary question. Can we distribute money to facilitate the efficient production and distribution of the goods and services? Take a look at Australian productivity. It's projected to grow at 1.6% for the next 40 years. Right? That's, again, the intergenerational report, the good one from 2010. Okay, it's going to grow at 1.6% for the next 40 years. What is US productivity projected to grow at? 1.6 to 1.7% for the indefinite future. Can we produce the goods and services? Now, there's a whole subtext here. I could spend one day talking about these problems and giving more examples, deeper logic to what is, and by necessity, a very quick overview here. But can we produce the goods and services? And productivity in services is extremely hard to measure. The Bureau of Stats knows that it doesn't do a very good measure. Actually, now that I mention the Bureau of Stats, one of my bugbears is that, the Australian Bureau of Statistics used to be the best Bureau of Statistics in the world, as judged by their peers. But it's being strained of resources and it's moving down the ranks. We need to actually give them more money so that we actually can have a fact-based economic argument rather than, being based on ideology and making things up. So, can we produce these goods and services? And the answer is yes, we can. Again, coming out of the intergenerational report, what is the growth in real GDP per person based on all of these things, population, participation and productivity? The percentage growth in real GDP per person is projected to be 1.5% per annum. Now, we all know the rule of 72. If we have something growing at 1.5% of 1.5% per annum, then we're basically going to be doubling GDP per person over the next 40 years. A little bit of rounding error there. So, given the basis of what we've got here in the intergenerational report, and that is especially once we realise what we're doing with respect to substantially underestimating the increase in productivity, we're basically going to double real GDP per person over the next 40 years, which means that this problem that was purportedly here early on, the number of people that we have actually supporting each person over 65 is going to not quite halve. Well, you can do the maths as well as I can. In fact, it's just arithmetic. GDP growth is not a problem. We are actually going to be able to produce the goods and services in the future to actually, with that smaller population of working people, proportionately smaller population of working people. It's actually going to increase, but it's proportionately smaller. We are going to produce the goods and services that are needed. This is what productivity is all about. We can get away with people working less and still having at least the same amount of goods and services being produced. That has been the benefit of the last 300 years of growth in Western Europe, particularly in the UK. We've had this incredible shift because of productivity that has enabled, instead of needing 90% of people on the land producing the farming goods, we now have, 2%? What? An incredible productivity. And when you think about it, that's an incredible shift of the population. And these sorts of movements that we have there, 6.5% to 10.8% of GDP over the next 50 years. Take a look at what the change is of the amount of GDP that has been spent or being produced in various sectors over the last 50 years. That is not a big change, 6.5% to 10.5%. We've had those changes before, even larger ones, in our lifetime, and we haven't noticed them. Until you sit down in retrospect and think, oh yeah, that's actually a pretty big change. We didn't notice them. This is, when you look at things like this, it looks like a big change. Oh, it's a problem. What are we going to do? It's not a problem. Right? Beware of the people who are telling you that it's going to be a problem, because they are really pushing an ideological process here. They're saying, hey, we've got to cut things like pensions. We've got to cut things like, the NDIS was way too costly. We shouldn't have promised it. We've got to cut those sorts of things. Oh, and while we're at it, we need to cut company tax too. We don't have to cut pensions and everything else like that. Right? Productivity-wise, we're still going to be able to produce those goods and services. What we need to do is actually ensure that we can distribute the resources appropriately. We're all aware of the danger of what happens if everybody saves, right? We actually start to get a depressed economy because we stop spending, which means that there is no demand for the goods that are being produced, which means that the factories start winding down. We put workers off. The workers still want to save the same amount, so they actually cut back, and you've got a negative spiral down into recession and then down into depression. Right. We have to make sure that the resources are distributed appropriately so that we can still have a fully functioning economy. And in particular, we want to avoid the US problem. And this is a moral argument. This is not an economic argument. I reckon we want to avoid the US problem in that there is very little rise in real income for the median worker in the US. Right. Over the last 20 or 30 years, all the productivity gains have actually gone to basically the top 10 to 20% of the population, more so into the top 1%. Right. A place where we'd all like to be, but of course only 1% of the population can be there by definition. So we want to avoid that problem. And there is the data coming from the US. Right? Who took median income there has been a bit of a rise, but for the last 20 or 10 years, not much there, and very small rise in total. So, right, what do we want to do there? Oh, by the way, who's Fred? That guy who's named up there. That's one of the great free databases around the world. It's the Federal Reserve Economic Database. A great resource to have at your fingertips to win arguments. Right. Right. So Bezina Hinton isn't here in the audience, is she? She got up in one of this morning's things and said she'd been Googling things during the talk just to look at things, and so what did the speaker think about that? Well, this is what you can do if you have an argument in work, if you know the FRED database. All right. Okay, so what are we talking about with supply and demand? The usual perspective is, hey, we're going to reduce the transfer of government funding of aged persons' expenditures, right? We don't want that because how are we going to tax everything? Well, paraphrasing what I said earlier, will an aged society have the demand to employ the workers. That's one of the problems we have to think about. Not how are we going to support the aged work, the aged, the pensioners and so forth, the aged population, but will the demand from that population actually be enough to employ the workers? It may be that the government will have to actually start increasing the pension just to make sure that there is enough demand to actually employ the workers. Because we've all got this increased productivity. You know, we're all getting scared these days about robots taking over our jobs. And it's not just the manufacturing jobs. We now have artificial intelligence that is going to take over the job of the actuaries. Right? 30 years ago when I worked with Greg Taylor, one of my, you know, my first job was basically, hey, here's these rules here. Can you actually now produce a computer program that can actually calculate what the reserves should be? And it doesn't take much intelligence to say, okay, now I've got that program. Let's just feed the data in automatically. Let's put a few rules as to how you calculate that. And hey, we've now got a mechanism that's going to calculate what the reserves should be, and it's not going to be biased. And all you expensive actuaries, goodbye, and our little robot over there is actually going to be doing all of that work, right? It's not their jobs that are going to be missing. This is important. It's your job that's going to get lost. So what we have to do is to make sure that we actually can give you enough resources so that you will still have the demand to keep the little robots active and their owners active, right? The current debate on secular stagnation, for those people who have heard that term, I think this is an important part of what we're seeing with secular stagnation. Again, one of the points that I have to jump quickly over. Which brings me back to an economic question. And for some reason or other, and I won't go into it, economics as a discipline has been declining over the last 20 or 30 years. Departments of economics are now departments of finance, right? But economics needs to be understood because a macro economy is very, very different to the sort of beast that we're used to, which is thinking in terms of a household or thinking in terms of a company. A macro economy acts nothing like a household, nothing like a company, because a macro economy is a closed circle. Right, a company and a household are not closed circles. There's massive inputs and there are massive outputs. But inside an economy, there is, you know, mostly it's self-contained, very little imports and exports. And we can easily think of that as being closed. My spending is someone else's income. Right? So how do we actually increase the income of society? We increase the spending in society. My saving is their borrowing or capital raising. And here is an important point. The government deficit means that there are more private sector assets. When the government spends money, it is actually increasing the amount of private sector assets. In fact, it's actually increasing the amount of risk-free, as close to risk-free as possible, private sector assets. And at the moment, the Australian market and every other market worldwide is saying there is a huge demand for risk-free assets. In fact, I was just told at lunchtime that the Australian 10-year bond has reached a new low in terms of interest rates. That's essentially saying that the market is telling the government, give me more loans. Give me more government bonds, right? So, you know, government deficits means we have more private sector assets. And conversely, a government surplus means that we have less private sector assets. When the government is running a surplus, it is saying, let's say the surplus is $100. Richard, can I have $100 from your bank or your wallet? And I'm just going to rip it up, burn it, whatever. That's what a government surplus is. The government takes more money than it spends, and it basically destroys that money. It can't put it anywhere because that's not a surplus then. The government surplus is actually destroying a private sector asset. Which is why I think it might have been in one of the plenary sessions we see that the US has continually run, you know, pretty much continually run deficits. The US government can't run surpluses for any reasonable point of time because that actually ends up destroying private sector assets. The Australian government can't run surpluses for any major length of time because it will destroy private sector assets, unless we're having a mining boom, in which case we can do it because there's private sector assets coming out of our ears. Okay, so basically there's your macroeconomic lesson for the day. Okay, what about private sector funding for pensions and all the rest of it? And here's wording from the, I think this is the intergenerational report. Unless action is taken to increase the growth potential of the economy, that's what I said earlier. The private sector needs to net save if we want the private sector to provide the future payments, which essentially means, in aggregate, the government needs to actually run a deficit, or else something needs to happen on the current account. But essentially, the simplest way is for the government to actually run a deficit if we want the private sector to actually effectively save. Again, it's not the sort of macroeconomy that you hear in the mainstream media, because that's been captured by ideologues. Sorry, Rupert, you are an ideologue. Hang on. Why don't the old people save in the private sector? And again, this is not a complete argument, but the younger people, why don't the old people save in the private sector? Well, what happens when they want the money? Right, I've been saving as I've gotten older and older, and now I've reached retirement and I actually need to get the money. I actually need to now sell my assets. Who am I going to sell it to? Well, who's actually earning the money at the moment? There used to be 4.5 workers for every person aged 65. Now there's 2.7 workers for everybody aged 65. So we've now got proportionately more people who are 65 trying to sell their assets to a smaller group of people who are coming through there, the ones who have the money. Okay, those people have to pay the older workers for their assets. But there's less of them, and there's a bucket load of assets that are being sold by the older people. It's the supply and demand question. What's going to happen to those, to the value of those assets? And also, we get up to the same question that people were talking about, in that it's not, we can't tax the younger people, the workforce, to actually pay for the old people. But if the old people actually have to sell their assets, where are the only people who are going to buy it is the younger people. So they either pay the older people via taxation, or they pay the older people by buying their assets. And if they don't want to buy the assets, then those assets are going to drop in value. Sorry, you people who are, 50-odd. I'm in my 60s and it doesn't really worry me that much because I'm selling my stuff now. But you people who are 50 or even in your 40s, if you think you're going to save, bad luck. By the time you get round to selling the assets, the market is going to be down there around about 3,000 instead of being up, somewhere in the 5,000s now. Of course, there's going to be a bucket load of other people selling the assets at the same time. Right. It is the same workers who have to actually pay the money to the older folk if they're actually going to live on it. Doesn't matter whether it's via taxation or whether it's buying those assets. It's the one group of people, right? Okay. What we have to do is to make sure we actually get the demand able to be reach the assets, reach the goods that are being generated by the workforce at that same point of time. Okay, so we've got to actually worry, you know, saving is not the complete answer. Once we start to deal with a macro economy and an intergenerational sense, right? The baby boomers, when they start to sell those assets down, are going to drive the prices down. Because the millennials and all the rest of it will not want to buy that many assets. Right. Okay. Now, oh, sorry, that might have sounded negative. It's not. It's merely saying that, hey, if you think private saving is going to help, get real. It's not going to help, right? Okay. Another thing in the macroeconomic sense, government borrowing is it's really a nonsense. Governments don't borrow money. Government bond is essentially an interest rate swap. The government has basically spent the money. It's sitting there in the Reserve Bank, sitting in the reserve accounts, and when you buy a government bond as a private sector entity, essentially what happens is that we reduce the cash that is in the reserve accounts and we now have a new asset, which is a government bond. The cash was paying a floating interest rate. The government bond is paying an interest rate that is known and for a set period of time. That's a straightforward interest rate swap. There is no more government liabilities. There already was a liability and we're paying the cash rate on that liability, which at the moment is, well, 1.75% versus 2.2% for the 10-year bonds. That's essentially we're getting 0.5% saving as the government by not borrowing. The money is sitting there and we're paying 1.75% on it. Right? That's not the only sort of swap that we would be able to do. If the government wants to actually be a little bit more innovative, and the government says that we need to be innovative, so why shouldn't they be innovative as well? Let's actually take a look at some other sorts of swaps. Maybe we can have inflation-linked payments. And, of course, we've already got inflation-linked bonds. Maybe we could have a bond that that pays something that's linked to nominal GDP. These bonds do not have to be issued with a price of 100. We could move them up and down. And something for government, to me, perpetuities are a great thing, right? Bonds eventually mature, which for most long-term asset liability problems is a problem, right? Whereas if we had a perpetuity, perhaps with the face value going up with inflation, there would be no maturity. We would actually know that as long as the government is able to print money, that we will be able to get a payment on that perpetuity. As an interest rate swap, it's just relatively straightforward. Instead of, hey, I'm going to pay you an interest rate determined by the Reserve Bank, I'm now going to pay you a known interest rate, a known coupon, on this particular face value. And it's just the price that you're going to pay things out there in the marketplace for that. Okay, so the standard partial solution that we've talked about, we can increase the liquidity of our non-liquid assets, negative mortgages, reduce taxes on transactions. Yep, fully agree. All the sorts of solutions that you actuaries have put forward, I fully agree with those. And it does actually make the economy more efficient. It's not getting rid of a problem because I contend there isn't a problem. The problem is what we actually put in as an economic problem rather than a financial problem. So I fully agree with this. Let's get rid of frictions in the economy. We need to remember, and this is coming up in conclusion, we need to remember that change happens in an economy. The last 40 years, we've seen massive change. You know, going back to the 1960s, you know, we got what is, in my humble opinion, the best science fiction movie ever done. Beat Star Wars, right? Beat Star Trek, which is the same vintage. But, you know, 2001, this is where we were thinking in the 1960s. This is where we were going to be in 2001. You know, the space station up there at the moment looks nothing like that. We can't predict what's going to be happening over 40 years. And the proportion of GDP, it doesn't matter. If that's what we want to do, that's what we want to do. We've seen massive changes over the previous 40 years. We're going to see massive changes over the next 40 years. We can't predict what will happen, but what will happen will be 40. You know, 40 years is a long time. It's going to be very gradual. We're going to be able to handle that degree of change. We also have to make sure when we're having this debate that we are actually having this debate in economic terms, not morality terms, right? Moral judgments can actually interfere with good economic decision making. Economic debt is not a moral issue. Every piece of debt needs two people. It needs a lender and a borrower. And, you know, what's the old adage? Well, the adage, neither a lender nor a borrower be, right? You've got the same problem. What's happening in the Eurozone? The problem is not that Greece borrowed too much. The problem is really that the French and German banks actually lent too much to Greece, right? That was a failure of the German regulator and the French regulator. They just don't want to own up, and the German and French governments have enough clout on the ECB that they can say, hey, it's your problem. And also, we have a moral judgment that we have that people who borrow money, in some sense, it's morally wrong. You shouldn't borrow money. But economically, it's actually quite good to borrow money. But we always have a moral judgment there. The reason is that when we use words like debt, it actually shows up that the linkage in our brain. Because we use the same word, and it's the same in every other language, there is a word that covers moral debts as well as economic debts. If you walk out there onto Collins Street and you're just about to walk in front of a tram and I pull you back, you are in my debt, right? You owe me something. You know, oh, God, I owe you that. Boy, you know, I owe you my life. You saved me, right? There is a moral term that we use, a moral debt, which cannot be met financially. But we use the same word to describe economic debts. And when we're using those words, unfortunately, a lot of times that we use the word debt, it pops up that moral overtone. And so we have to be very careful about that. When we're making economic decisions, we have to try and get rid of the moral sense that we're having here. We also have to be aware of status snobbery, right? Caring service jobs that do not require a university degree or much training, they're menial, right? Why should I pay that person a high salary? They don't need any training. Yeah. Hey, you know, the person who's looking after my grandmother, no training there. She's just going in there. She's having to lift it. She has to have her shower and all the rest of it. Why should I pay her a high salary? I could do that job easily. That's status snobbery, right? Why are we finding it so hard to get people to do those jobs? Because we're not paying enough. We're paying them less than a quarter of what we're paying you guys. Why? Essentially, snobbery. It's not that we have people clamouring to do those jobs and that's why the salary goes down and nobody wants to be an actuary, that's why your salary is high. It is social snobbery, status snobbery. Hey, I had to study for 6, 7, 8, 9 years to do this. I deserve to be given a high salary. No, you don't. Don't deserve anything. Right. Philosophically, that's how I agree, but I've never knocked my salary back. Okay, we have to be aware that these are moral problems. They are not economic problems. They're status problems. It's not an economic problem. If we need a large increase in the number of workers, right, we actually need to increase their wages. That's the standard economic argument for it. So we double their wages. Are we still getting enough people there? No, we're not. Okay. Why? Because it's shitty work. Well, so we keep increasing the wages until people do it. We worked in the mining industry. They kept increasing wages until they got enough people. So if it works in the mining industry, why can't it work in the service industry? Status snobbery. Essentially it. So the conclusion. The problems raised with ageing are a false perspective. The wrong words that we're using are going to frame the debate and will lead to suboptimal solutions. We're framing the debate completely wrongly. We have to make sure that we cast the debate in macroeconomic terms, and we also have to cast the debate so that fewer unconscious moral and status problems are coming into the debate. And anybody who's seen the movie on Margaret Thatcher, I thought this was actually in the movie. I thought that was actually a quote from Margaret Thatcher, but it's not. Right, that was actually written for the movie. So Meryl Streep speaking as Margaret Thatcher, and here is the problem that we're facing with ageing. It is a problem of words. Watch your thoughts, for they become words. Watch your words, for they become actions. Watch your actions, for they become habits. And watch your habits, for they become character. And watch your character, for it becomes your destiny. What we think, we become. My father always said that. So that's what we need to do. We are thinking in the wrong way about this problem. And that means that we are going to end up, you know, as the character of what we're thinking about with this is going to be the wrong way. And we need to make sure that we frame the debate in the proper macroeconomic and historical perspective. Essentially, don't worry, be happy. That's what we want to be. That's what I want out of this particular talk. And I heard the bell toll, so send not to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for me. So I think we only have 5 minutes for questions.
Thanks for that, Frank. I can see Richard's already ready for his first question, so...
You were worried that
it
wouldn't be.
Richard Lyon. Frank, that was fantastic as always. I love being reminded by you of all the things I should have known, used to know, keep forgetting. Demonstrated yesterday in our presentation that I'd largely forgotten. But thank you also for referencing our graph of the US deficit from yesterday's session. What we were trying to say yesterday, what I think comes out from what you're saying today is, I mean, very definitely forget about the numbers, forget about the household budget approach. Let's really start getting that debate onto how you get everybody properly looked after in this future environment. So you went across that question of the lack of growth in the median income in the US in real terms. And while we put that US deficit graph up, we also said we don't want to be the US. We don't think that's That's right. And that's what the debate needs to be here. It needs to get away from the household budget and back onto the real stuff about how we ensure that, that everyone gets properly looked after in old age, in their youth, on the way through, all the disadvantaged and everybody else.
Yep. Thanks for that. And yeah, I thought when I was sitting in your talk yesterday that it was very complimentary to mine. And it also struck me with a few other talks that I've been in today that pretty much we had a, if it had been structured differently, we had a one-day colloquium on the challenges that we're going to have, the positive challenges of an aging population, and necessary for the Institute and other professional bodies and non-professional groups to actually push the debate in the way that we want it, it should be going. Yeah. Any group from the actuaries who are doing this, and remember that I'm not an actuary, that'd be fully endorse what you're doing, because from what I've seen, it's the right direction.
Jeff Humphries, thanks, Frank. I'd never miss one of your presentations. If I'm right, Japan's at the forefront of the non-challenges of an ageing population. What could we learn from their situation?
What we can learn from their situation is that beware of looking at GDP, because GDP per capita has actually not. When you look at GDP per capita, Japan is actually going not as bad as everybody is saying. Also, we need to be aware from an economic sense that if you fall into this sort of deflationary process, that it can be very difficult to get out of it. So there's macroeconomic questions to look at there, and also that older people tend to get stuck in the mud. And in that case, there's a lot of small villages and so forth that where the people have, 30 years ago, they were still working on their farms when they were 70. And so you had a fantastic growth in terms of small farming equipment, small tractors and other things like that that worked there. And now they're 100. They can't work on their farm fields anymore. But the kids in the city don't want to sell their farm fields because of various tax-effective structures there. So the tax problem is, the tax structure is actually exacerbating the Japanese problem, because these farms actually have value that they don't want to realise and sell and get into the city. So, yeah, there's all sorts of structural impediments. But Japanese society is not going as bad as most people think, at least from my personal experience and my reading. It sounds bad, but when you actually take a look at what is happening, it's actually not as bad as is made out. Could do better, but it's at the forefront, but it's not doing too badly.
Yeah. Okay, sounds like the bells have rung. Can we please have a round of applause for Frank again?
Cheers.